This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Hammering wooden pegs is just one of several hands-on activities that make up the new Building Rogers exhibit at the Rogers Historical Museum. The exhibit, which explores the architectural heritage of Rogers from its founding through the 1960s, was made possible by a $14,000 grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Jessica Whitehead, Curator of Education, and John Burroughs, Assistant Director of the Museum, say the architectural history of the town is an important topic to explore.
I think it's important because it's summed up in what we do in terms of historic preservation. It's appreciating what came before us and taking a moment to understand, you know, not just the beauty or the technical aspects of these buildings, but that they're a part of our history and that they tell the story of the people who once used them. The people may no longer be here, but these buildings are still a part of our town, the fabric of our town, and they give our town's character and they help define what our history has been. So
it's an easily accessible way to look at history. You know, anybody can walk down the street and look at a building, where, you know, if you have a collection of photographs, not everybody will be able to see those at any given time, but anyone can see a building. And the ones that aren't there, you can still look at the photographs, but the ones that are still there, I think most people can look at a building and have an idea, yes, that is a very old building, and, you know, a lot of people are curious and would like to learn more about some of the things that they see on a regular basis.
Some of the other materials children can play with include a workbench with plastic tools, a level, and a plumb bob. Visitors can also put together sink drain pipes or learn how to use a brace and bit. One of the more quiet activities is a tub full of foam blocks children can use to construct brick walls, houses, or whatever their imaginations can create. For adults, there are blue informational boards hanging along the walls. They feature facts about architects, builders, suppliers, famous buildings, construction methods, and historic preservation. Burroughs says the mixture of content with fun activities helps make the exhibit interesting to many of their visitors.
The text panels that you see on the walls, most adults I think would really enjoy reading about the architects and the builders and building suppliers, learning about what's happened with historic preservation in the community and how buildings have been built in the past. I think kids are going to like this because there's the opportunity to just play and use their imaginations and actually put their hands on tools that they're not that familiar with and hopefully inspire them to want to know more about the subject. So I think there's a good division in the types of information that we've presented and how it's been presented. So.
And a lot of people are interested in this kind of thing. It's the same thing where they see these buildings, but they don't know anything about them. So when we have told people that we're going to have an exhibit about architecture, they usually have a specific building, or is this building going to be in your exhibit? Because they're curious about those things. This information just... people don't know much about them specifically, so they're very interested.
We've had a lot of people in the past that have purchased older homes in the community that come here researching and wanting to know more about the history of that building and the people who once owned it and lived in them. So I think buildings are probably as important to our daily lives as anything. It's when you think about it, it defines the space around us and how we live, and I think that's probably what draws people into this subject.
The family-friendly exhibit also features photographs, documents, and tools. Some of the items found in display cases come from the museum's collection, while others have been lent to the museum by local architects.
In one display case, we have a display of objects that explore architectural drafting and architectural training. So we have some old architectural textbooks, some drafting equipment, and an example of a schematic that was drawn by one of our local architects, Bell Dinwiddie, in the it looks like the 40s, late 40s. So, and Bell Dinwiddie is an interesting example. She was not only one of our few architects in the area during that time, she was also a female architect, particularly when there were not a lot of female architects practicing.
The other display cases feature bricks from some of the town's historic buildings, as well as an early example of a home kit.
In this display case, we have some of the tools of the trades. We have some old hand tools. We have a great example of how shingles were once made with a fro and a mallet. We have some old hand tools. An example of the Van Winkle mill, the house kits that Peter Van Winkle sold after the Civil War, and that was a very early example of home kits being made available for people, and that was even before home kits from catalogs such as Sears and Roebuck were available. So he was a little bit ahead of his time then. He would sell lumber, pre-cut home plans, and provide the fixtures.
Yes.
Museum employees have also created an educational program that can be presented in schools.
We have a program that we can take into the classroom where we have some of the same examples of the types of tools that you would see in the exhibit, and not quite as extensive activities as this, but the kids will be able to do things. Depending on their age group, the activity might be making a paper house, or it might be drawing a house plan. Obviously the younger kids will do the more simple activities, and they can still see some of the examples. We visit a lot of classrooms in all of the area schools. Some of the kids get to come to the museum, not all of them do, so we try to give them the opportunity to have the program here or in the classroom. And we will also have loan materials available for teachers to use on their own time.
Whitehead adds that the subject matter can teach students about more than just architecture.
There are a lot of opportunities with architecture to tie into other areas of curriculum instead of just history. The teachers can use this to move on through different areas in science and math, especially because it all ties together. You can't have the architecture without the science and the math behind it, so it can cross the curriculum in many ways.
Building Rogers is now on display at the Rogers Historical Museum. Admission is free, and the museum is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday. More information is available by calling 479-621-1154.
Earth, sky.
Scientists have discovered a connection between gut bacteria, the bacteria that live in our intestines, and multiple sclerosis, a disease of the brain and spinal cord. Earth Sky spoke with Dr. Sarkis Mazmanian, a biologist at Caltech.
I wouldn't go as far as saying that gut bacteria cause MS. I would say that gut bacteria contribute to the inflammatory response that induces or that promotes the symptoms of MS.
In other words, bacteria might help along the symptoms of MS or multiple sclerosis, symptoms like paralysis and lethargy. He said he observed the progression of MS in two different groups of mice, mice with normal gut bacteria and mice with no gut bacteria at all.
The animals with the gut bacteria had an inflammatory response in the brain and the central nervous system, consistent with disease.
They got sick with MS, that is. But the mice without intestinal bacteria showed no symptoms. Dr. Mazmanian said his results suggest that some kinds of gut bacteria might contribute heavily to MS. But he added scientists still don't know which bacteria or combination of bacteria might be causing problems. Mazmanian said someday patients might be able to alter their own gut bacteria through diet or medication. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Earlier this month, a poll of voters in Arkansas's 1st and 2nd congressional districts indicated the Republican candidates in those races have double-digit leads over their opponents from the Democratic Party. Late last week, a new poll conducted by Talk Business and Hendricks College gathered numbers for the 3rd and 4th congressional districts. Roby Brock, the editor and publisher of TalkBusiness.net and a regular contributor to Ozarks at Large, recently sat down with Jay Barth, a professor of political science at Hendricks College, to discuss the latest polls for Arkansas's congressional races.
Let's start with the 4th and work our way backwards. It would appear that Congressman Mike Ross has a safe lead in the district, But his reelect numbers seem a little lower than you might expect for a long-term incumbent like him. What's your take?
Well, I think, you know, considering the environment we're in and taking into context the troubles that other Democrats are having in this state and across the country, I think that, you know, that Congressman Ross has to feel pretty good right now, is that it seems that he has really made it through this really tough period for Democrats and goes into the fall with a good good reelect number. It may not be what he would have been used to in the last couple of cycles, but it's still very solid, and I think he has to feel pretty good about where things are. You know, he's got a slight majority lead. He's held together the Democratic constituency in South Arkansas pretty well, despite the fact that he has really distanced himself from the party nationally. So I think he's in pretty solid shape.
Something that we've seen in much of our polling data is that there seems to be a generic ballot advantage for Republicans at this juncture of the cycle. There's not really been any major money spent between Republicans or Democrats yet, which can greatly influence a race. But what do you think is contributing to Democratic dissatisfaction? Does that necessarily mean that Republicans are beloved?
Well, I think that neither party is beloved. I mean, I think when you look at the evaluations of the two parties, we see a big shift towards independents over the last couple of years. We see the party leaders of both parties in Congress with very negative ratings. So this is, I think, in many ways kind of an anti-party environment, in that it is a rejection of the status quo in general, and I think the parties are seen as part of the problem, both Republican and Democrat. But certainly the fact that President Obama is the President of the United States, his programs are pretty unpopular, especially here in Arkansas, and he himself is pretty unpopular in Arkansas. His own personal approval ratings have held up a lot better around the country. It's really his programs that have really taken a hit here in Arkansas. You know, when you look back to 2008, you know, Barack Obama never connected with Arkansans, and that has only worsened in the last couple of years. And Arkansas Democrats, especially those running for federal office, are really feeling the brunt of that.
In the 3rd District, Republican Steve Womack has that 24-point lead over Democrat David Whitaker, 55-31%. Did anything surprise you about those numbers?
No, it feels very much like you would expect the 3rd District to feel in an open seat race. These are really neither candidate super well known. Mayor Womack better known because he's been around for a while, and he had a tough primary and runoff. But even he is not known by all the voters of the district, as many voters will get to know him in the months ahead. But he's in solid shape, and I was born in 1966. That was the year Republicans elected a congressman in that district, the area covered by the present 3rd District, and they haven't elected a Democrat since. And so I think we have just that kind of cemented Republican success in the 3rd District, and so nothing that would surprise us.
At the 3rd and the 4th District, combined with our 1st and 2nd District numbers, which showed leads for Republicans, except they're in the 4th, what conclusions can you draw about the state of Arkansas politics from all of this?
Well, I think we clearly know that this is a very bad time for Democrats in Arkansas, and especially in these federal races, that there's a lot of antipathy towards the Democrats. I think the big question is this just a bad year, or something that represents a more permanent shift towards the Republican Party in this state? And I think in many ways we may not get that evidence from these federal races, but I think it's really at the state level in state politics, and especially in state legislative races, where Republicans have always had just such problems. If they have success there, that's really what will signal a truly permanent realignment where we would expect long-term Republican success in this state. So I think we've still got some question marks. We know it's a good year to be a Republican, but is it a sign of a permanent shift or just some blowing winds in 2010?
Jay, kind of a twofold question. Do you think that there's enough time? And B, if there is, what factors do you think could influence a reversal of Democratic fortunes?
Well, I think there is time in most of these races, in that you look at a lot of races, and we'll use the first district as a good example, in that, you know, voters in the first district really don't have a good feel for either of those candidates, for Chad Causey or for Rick Crawford. And so the campaign is really going to shape how those candidates are evaluated. And so while Crawford has some advantage because he's a Republican in this year, we still got a lot of time left in that race. I think we got some other races, like the 4th District race, where we got a lot more locked in view of the candidates, especially of Mike Ross, and even in the 2nd District, where Joyce Elliott's been around for a good while, and of course Tim Griffin got a lot of attention while he was U.S. Attorney, and the controversy that ensued about his holding that post. And so those candidates are a little better known. That race may be a little more cemented, but there's a great deal of variation from race to race. But there is a lot of time left. There's a lot of time for candidates to make mistakes or for candidates to really shine. And, you know, of course, Labor Day is the traditional start of the campaign season, and this has been a darn hot summer in Arkansas. And I think that people really have been disconnected from politics, and they will begin to reengage when we get back from the Labor Day break.
Roby Brock is the editor and publisher of TalkBusiness.net. He talked with Jay Barth, professor of political science at Hendricks College. You can see all the results of the recent Talk Business Hendricks College polls at TalkBusiness.net. Support for Roby's coverage of Arkansas politics and business is provided by the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. Bank of the Ozarks, all the bank you need. More information is available at bankozarks.com. It's Tuesday, August 31st, 2010. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin, the editor of What's Up, the entertainment section of Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So it's one of those things that tells you it's fall. Today is the start of the Washington County Fair. Carnival rides, cows, and snow cones. Admission today is just $1. On Wednesday, school and church students are admitted for free from 10 to 3. Senior citizens are admitted for free from 10 to 5 on Thursday. And on Friday, there's Midnight Madness from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m., where you can get a $5 discount on carnival wristbands $5 discount if you have a Pepsi can. It's that time of year. MyWashingtonCountyFair.com. There's also an opening reception tonight, much more elegant, one supposes, for Cross Purpose, an exhibit from the Edward and Diane Nippers collection. It features imagery of the cross from the 6th century to contemporary art. The reception is 6 to 7:30 tonight at the gallery at John Brown University in Siloam Springs, and the exhibit will continue through September 24th. And perhaps even more upscale, a poetry night featuring Ozark Poets and Writers Collective board members performing their works at 7 o'clock at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. You can find out more at ozarkwriters.wordpress.com.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, the entertainment section found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers every Friday.
This is BBC Television from London. Diana, Princess of Wales, has died after a car crash in Paris.
On this date in 1997, Britain's Princess Diana died in a car crash in Paris, France, at the age of 36. Her parents divorced when she was young, and her father won custody of her and her siblings. She became Lady Diana Spencer after her father inherited the title of Earl Spencer in 1975. After attending finishing school, she moved to London and became a kindergarten teacher. Diana married Prince Charles on July 29, 1981. The ceremony was broadcast on television around the world. The couple had two sons together. Initially overwhelmed by her royal duties and the intense media coverage of her life, she began to develop and pursue her own interests. Diana served as a strong supporter of many charities and worked to help the homeless, people living with HIV and AIDS, and children in need. Diana and her husband became estranged over the years, and their separation was announced in December 1992 by British Prime Minister John Major. The divorce was finalized in 1996. After the divorce, Diana devoted herself to her sons and to charitable efforts such as the battle against the use of landmines. She also continued to experience the negative effects of fame. Her 1997 romance with an Egyptian film producer and playboy created a media frenzy. While visiting Paris, the couple was involved in a car crash after trying to escape from the paparazzi on the night of August 30th. Although Diana initially survived the crash, she later succumbed to her injuries at a Paris hospital a few hours later. French authorities investigated the crash, and the driver was found to have a high level of alcohol in his system at the time of the accident. The role of the pursuing photographers in the tragedy was also scrutinized. The funeral was held at Westminster Abbey, which was broadcast on television. Her body was later buried at her family's estate. On the 10th anniversary of her death, her sons honored their mother with a special concert. The proceeds went to charities supported by Diana and her sons. John James Doyne, the first president of what is now called the University of Central Arkansas, ended his presidency on this date in 1917. UCA was created by the passage of Act 317 of 1907 as Arkansas State Normal School, the only institution of higher learning in the state created for the sole purpose of teacher training. The curriculum for the Bachelor of Arts was not created until 1920. The school grew rapidly and went from approximately 100 students in 1908 to 200 students in 1909. Before Doyne left office, enrollment reached 441 students in 1916. Violinist Itzhak Perlman was born on this date in 1945 in Tel Aviv, Palestine. Despite a bout with polio that left his legs paralyzed, he was a prodigy and made his U.S. television debut at age 13. Recognition of his gifts led to a highly successful career as orchestral soloist and chamber music player with scores of recordings. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Tonight, beginning at 7 p.m., KUAF will feature special coverage from NPR News. As Iraq assumes its own security and the U.S. officially moves into an advisory and backup role, President Obama addresses the nation. Join Robert Siegel, along with NPR correspondents and senior editors, for live, in-depth coverage and analysis. President Obama addresses the nation. As the formal U.S. combat mission in Iraq draws to a close, tonight, beginning at 7 p.m. on KUAF 91.3 FM. Omni Book Forums will continue September 3rd with the second forum in the series on Afghanistan and Pakistan. It takes place that evening at 6 at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville and will feature panelists speaking on a number of books on the subject. It's free and open to the public. For more information, email Dick Bennett at jbennett@uark.edu. You're listening to Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. County fairs are full of all kinds of vendors serving fresh ice-cold lemonade and sugary sweet funnel cake. In addition to the piles of deep-fried goodness available from vendors, there are tons of homemade items on exhibition. At the Washington County Fair, chefs young and old display their homemade creations for judges to rank. The judges are volunteers who must attend a judging school so they know what standards to look for when critiquing submissions. Catherine Koch, County Extension Agent in Family and Consumer Sciences, explains.
The Extension Service, so the University of Arkansas Division of Ag, we hold judging schools periodically and invite anyone who is interested in learning to judge to come to those judging schools. Last year, we held one in Eureka Springs and invited you know, I send out newsletters or an announcement, you know, through our extension newsletter to people who are involved with an extension, inviting anyone who's interested to go and to judge, to go to the judging school. And we had 15 who participated last year. And these people then, along with the others who have been judging for many years, are invited to come to other county fairs to judge. And so all of our judges have been through a judging school when they come to our county.
Children and adults can exhibit their edible creations in two categories, food preparation and food preservation. Food preparation includes baked items like cakes and pies, while food preservation involves canned fruits and vegetables. Ramona Gordon used to be a home economist with a cooperative extension service. She's been retired for 16 years and will help judge the items submitted for the food preservation section of the Junior Home Economics Division at the 2010 County Fair.
One of the first questions that I often have asked is, so do you sample all the food? Do you taste all the food? Well, in things like food preparation, like the baking and things like that, yes, you do. But in food preservation, you don't taste the food. You don't open the jars because that would break the seal, and then those foods would not be available for display the rest of the fair because they would spoil once the seal has been broken. So you don't open the jars. You don't taste the food. There's also a safety issue there because home canned vegetables, for example, should really not be eaten without further cooking and heating, just in case there were any food spoilage bacteria that survived the food processing. And so you certainly don't want to get food poisoning. So, no, we do not open the jars when we're judging canned foods. I like to tell people it's really more of like a beauty contest because it's pretty much all based on appearance.
Volunteers judge the food based on specific standards. In food preparation, exhibitors are judged on outside and internal appearance, as well as flavor. For food preservation, items are judged based on texture, uniformity, the state of the canning jar, as well as the maturity of the food.
Some of the things that we look for, you know, because there are standards by which you judge them. And, for example, with your vegetables, you're going to look for the maturity of the product. An example of that is if the green beans are over mature, you're going to see loose beans in the jar as opposed to not seeing the beans. You're going to see more starchy residue, which would indicate an over maturity. With your fruits and things like that, you're going to see more ragged edges as opposed to clean cuts and that kind of thing.
Gordon says, particularly for the younger children, this is a learning experience, so the judges will often give constructive criticism.
There is a scorecard, and, you know, as judges, we try to give suggestions to the children of what they need to do to improve. And we might check off things on the scorecard. That's just a kind of a time-saving thing so that you don't have to manually write everything out. You can circle something on the scorecard or check it or highlight it if they've done a good job or something like that. You know, so those are some little time-saving things for the judges. But especially with the children, we want to give them as much feedback as possible because it's a learning experience for them.
When judging, volunteers award one of three ribbons to each exhibit.
Based on those judging standards, we can kind of separate the products into, okay, this is a blue ribbon quality, this is red ribbon quality, this has some more things wrong with it, this is white ribbon. So blue is, you know, outstanding. That's excellent, excellent quality. Your red is more of kind of just your standard. And the white usually has some things that need some definite improvement on. If they've absolutely broken a rule, like they didn't use the standard canning jar, then it may even be totally disqualified and no ribbon at all. Okay, so once you've kind of separated them out into the classes, you know, like blue, red, and white, then we begin to look for, you know, the very best out of that one. In each category, we will pull out what we think is the best in that category. And then when it comes down to doing the grand champion of that whole department, we look at the best from each class to then pick what we think is the best overall of anything in the fair.
The ribbons translate to premium dollars, which participants can receive for each of their submissions. Gordon says the money helps reimburse exhibitors for what it costs them to bake or can their food. Koch says one reason so many people participate in the exhibition is because of pride.
I think people feel a great deal of pride in things that they do, their skills that they have, and it's a way of sharing with other people your knowledge and your skills about, well, you've asked about food preservation, food preparation, but also there's all the needle arts, the different crafts, the fine arts, photography. All of these things are on exhibit for residents of Washington County and surrounding counties to come and see. And you feel a great deal of success when you see your project that you've worked hard on and have taken a great deal of pride, you know, hanging, you know, in front of all of the county residents to see. And it, you know, has a blue ribbon or a red ribbon or a white ribbon on it.
Gordon adds that education and tradition are two more reasons for participation.
There is the educational aspect, especially for the 4-H kids, because they do their 4-H educational projects, and some of them, food preservation might be their project. So this is their way of demonstrating, you know, what they've learned. Plus, it's something then that they can report in their record book. You know, they compete for scholarships and awards and prizes and everything based on their record books and their work that they do as a 4-H'er. So this, again, is just a way to contribute to that. So it becomes very important for 4-H kids. Now, 4-H kids aren't the only ones who participate. For some, it's just a fun learning environment. It's kind of, you know, in 4-H we talk about learning by doing, actually having the experience. It's one thing to read about it in a book. It's another thing to actually do it, you know, and learn it. So I think that I would say that's the number one thing for the kids. There is the opportunity to earn a little premium money. It's a fun way to learn and then to showcase what they have learned. For the adults, I think it just kind of goes back to, one is supporting the county fair as a tradition, as a way of life for rural people especially. It's just for most of the people who exhibit at the fair, it's probably been a part of their life from childhood. So it's like a tradition, you know, that's carried on. A lot of the volunteers who work in the fair have been involved with the fair, perhaps even from their childhood.
The Washington County Fair runs from August 31st to September 4th. The fairgrounds are located between Garland and I-540 in Fayetteville. More information is available by calling 479-587-0847 or by visiting mywashingtoncountyfair.com. While temperatures have finally cooled off over the last week, the summer of 2010 will be a record breaker. When August comes to an end today, Central Arkansas will have had the highest average temperature for the months of June, July, and August. And senior forecaster John Lewis at the National Weather Service in North Little Rock says that's not all.
We've already broken a couple of records this summer, one for consecutive 90-degree days, And we also had a string of 77 consecutive days where temperatures were at least 70 degrees or warmer. That's for daytime lows. That's never been done before. So very consistent heat. Didn't have that in 1954, which was considered a very hot summer, and didn't have that in 1980. Both of those years, we had period of cool weather in June. That was not the case this year.
As we head into the fall and winter, Lewis says we can expect conditions to be warmer and drier than normal. Arkansas's first hard liquor distillery is now shipping out its first product and celebrating the facility's grand opening. Rocktown Distillery is making vodka, bourbon, and gin in downtown Little Rock using all Arkansas grains and ingredients. Founder Phil Brandon gave a tour of the facility near the Heifer International headquarters for local business people.
This is the bourbon is aging, 125 proof Arkansas bourbon, Arkansas's first legal bourbon ever made. These barrels were made from tight white oak in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Because we use small barrel aging, it helps the spirit age a lot faster. So that's how we're able to release a bourbon in 6 months instead of 6 years.
The liquor will be distributed to restaurants and stores around Central Arkansas under the label Brandon's. Registration is taking place now for a six-week short story writing class, which begins September 2nd at the Miller Branch of the Fort Smith Public Library. It will meet Thursdays from 10 a.m. to noon and is free, but registration is limited. For more information or to reserve a spot in this class, 479-646-3945. Kevin Welch will perform two concerts in the KUAF listening area in the next few weeks. He'll be at Good Folk Productions in Fayetteville on September 10th and in Eureka Springs at the Unitarian Church on September 11th. For more information, kevinwelch.com. This is Ozarks at Large. For fiber artist Mary Tate, it's curtains. And an occasional slipcover. Perhaps a pillow. Basically, it's all about the drape. Jacqueline Froelich provides this profile.
This drizzly summer morning, Mary Tate sits at one of a half dozen workstations in her white, very white studio on White Street in Eureka Springs, stitching applique, an undulating 2-inch wide piece of cotton trim tape, on a large caviar bronze satin cloth.
So I'm working on a piece that's going to Austin, Texas, and this is what I call scroll work.
The scroll work will embellish the bottoms of two Roman shades she's creating.
So it's very time consuming, but has a lot of integrity, and it's kind of a wow factor when people come by and see the work, because it takes so long to do, stitch by stitch, quarter inch by quarter inch.
Born and raised in New Orleans, Tate took a degree in painting from Louisiana Tech University, where she helped to develop a fiber arts program after visiting several weavers on a trip to Eureka Springs in the 1970s. She later established her own fabric studio in New Orleans and for decades worked for designers across America. She's married to New Orleans native Christopher Fisher, a preservationist and photographer, and together they're raising one daughter, Indigo. Even after the family fled the ravages of Katrina to Eureka, Tate maintained two studios for a while, helping with massive reparations work in New Orleans. But when that quelled, she closed shop there to operate solely here. And she brought her familial old-world Cajun, French, British style with her.
Not in a traditional way, not in so much of a functional way, but in more like a European integuments of color. I mean, I have more of a sensibility of the gumbo that's involved in the design work and the sensibility of the people that live in New Orleans and their sense of style.
Tate spends her days sewing commissioned window treatments and furniture coverings in her spacious turn of the 20th century two-story studio.
So I work to the trade, and technically I am a curtain workroom. I work to the trade, which means I don't work for the public in general. I work for architects and designers that professionally do that, that come to me, that drop ship the fabrics to me. I don't purchase the fabrics. But I control what goes in the fabrication of the curtains. Like, I control the linings and the heavy flannels. So we have good quality, consistent quality of those things that go into the making of these curtains.
Tate collects heirloom fabrics, which serve as models, and period furnishings, which fill the family home on Ridgeway a few blocks away. It's likely that one day Mary Tate articles will be coveted heirlooms. She just doesn't realize it yet. And she is old school, still uses paper patterns to trace her designs, while most others have gone high tech. Dottie, an adopted King Charles Cavalier, helps out in the studio, greeting clients and patrons when not sleeping on her vintage fabric scrap nest. Nearby stand several really old machines.
So my sewing machines are the basic old Singer industrial machines. They don't even reverse. They only go forward, and they'll sew 10 thicknesses of canvas beautifully. But there are also specialized machines that people use in the construction of curtains, like the overlock machine, which is a serger and overlocks the stitch and cuts at the same time, so there's no raveling that happens. So I would like to play my serger for you. Turned on. It has a beautiful, mellow sound to it. So you can play a higher pitch and go faster, or a lower pitch and go slower.
Tate, who is tall and willowy with waist-long brown hair and perfect posture, has worked a stable of apprentices over the years, and many of them sew by hand.
The reason that we like to focus on stitching by hand, many of the fabrics that we use are Fortuny fabrics, or they're silk velvet fabrics that are made in Venice, expensive $400 a yard fabrics that need to have the attention of hand stitching.
Tate says she first learned to sew when she was little, but instead of purchasing clothing patterns mass-produced by McCall, Simplicity, and even Vogue, she created her own clothing line in high school.
Because I could make things that were unusual, that I couldn't buy anywhere, and I could have twice as many clothes as normal. So clothes is what I made as a teenager. But now I don't make a stitch of clothing because I can't stand stitching clothing anymore. I really enjoy making working in the larger format with curtains, which is kind of like sculpture when you think about it.
Technically, Tate's considered a curtain fabricator and fiber surface designer. Her work's been featured in several design books as well as tabletop magazines, including Southern Accents, Traditional Home, House Beautiful, New Orleans Home and Lifestyle, and the most recent issue of Architectural Digest. Much of her portfolio developed while working in New Orleans' interior design district.
It was an artisan article on me called The Draper's Art, which showed many different styles of headings that I had developed. And New Orleans being a mecca at that time for the luscious involvement of people as they entertain, as they live in their homes so much with these interiors that are just sexy and volumetric and interesting. A takeoff from there for me was to bring it into an artisan type of consideration. I started making paper trims and stenciling on fabric and weaving paper slip covers and paper curtains and just bringing an artistic angle to the regular JCPenney Sears type of concept that everyone had of curtains.
After the 95 article, certain elements of Tate's design, she says, were popularized by the retail industry and started appearing in American home culture, yet she's not created her own label. Over the years, Tate's worked with top-notch designers such as Jerry Bremerman, Lee Ledbetter, Ralph Harvard, Marjorie Souchon, and Rosemary James.
Trent Reznor, who's a great musician. Tom Hanks, we work for Peter Weller. Cela Ward, Emeril Lagasse. This one pair of decorators, Holden and Dupuy, their work is singular and noticeable, and it's got this elegant, comfortable feel that people all over the country have noticed it in magazines and through other design homes that they've seen and have hired them to do a lot of work. And so when we were in New Orleans, we were their main workroom. They gave me license to be very creative.
You've seen Mary Tate's work if you've ever watched the film Interview with a Vampire.
So I had the privilege of working with Dante Ferretti, a famous artistic designer for film. I got to see it filmed, you know, with Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise, and it was really exciting. In fact, the night that they filmed was a full moon in this beautiful Destrehan plantation, all filmed in candlelight. There were thousands of candles. It was a very exciting and wonderful experience.
Mary Tate's studio is a trove of collectible linens, silks, satins, cottons, even cashmere and mohair. Bolts of fabric hang from dowels, lace stacked on shelves, and are spread across tables, ready for her 13-inch long shears. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more, visit MaryTate, that's TAIT.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 31st of August, 2010. 1422, on this day, Henry VI became King of England. He was 9 months old, the only child of Henry V. In 1423, the year after he ascended to the throne, English nobles from around the country swore loyalty to this tiny child and also set up a regency council to make government decisions until he was old enough to do that. And it was about a century and a half later that William Shakespeare wrote about Henry VI, wrote three plays which were among Shakespeare's earliest. They were big box office successes at the time. These days they're hardly ever performed anywhere, though they contain some quotable lines. It was in the Henry VI plays that Shakespeare said, "Defer no time, delays have dangerous ends." He said, "Suspicion always haunts the guilty mind. The thief doth fear each bush and officer." And Shakespeare wrote, "Smooth runs the water where the brook is deep." It's the birthday of William Shawn, born Chicago, 1907, was the editor of the New Yorker magazine for 35 years. He personally edited a great deal that went into the magazine, including Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. William Shawn, who said, "Amid chaos of images, we value coherence. We believe in the printed word, and we believe in clarity, and we believe in immaculate syntax, and in the beauty of the English language." And it's the birthday of Maria Montessori, born on this day in Chiaravalle, Italy, 1870. Against her father's wishes, she wanted to study engineering, so she went to a technical school. All of her classmates were boys. After a few years, switched over to medicine, became the first woman in Italy to earn an MD degree. As a doctor, she worked with children with special needs, and it was through that work that she became interested in education. She believed that children were not blank slates, that they each had inherent individual gifts, and it was a teacher's job to help the children find those gifts rather than dictate what a child should know. She emphasized independence, self-directed learning, and learning from peers. And she was one of the first to use tables and chairs in the classroom that were made for smaller people. And after Mussolini kicked her out of Italy, she went to India and worked there. Here's a poem for today by Kenneth Rexroth, This Night Only. Moonlight now on Malibu, the winter night, the few stars far away, millions of miles, the sea going on and on forever around the earth, far and far as your lips are near, filled with the same light as your eyes. Darling, 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 the future is long gone by, and the past will never happen. We have only this, our one forever, so small, so infinite, so brief, so vast, immortal as our hands that touch, deathless as the firelit wine we drink, almighty as this single kiss that has no beginning, that will never, never end. This Night Only, a poem by Kenneth Rexroth from Sacramental Acts, the love poems of Kenneth Rexroth, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, producers of Poetry Everywhere, a new series of films featuring contemporary poets. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Scheutzker. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Berryville, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen at our website, kuaf.com. KUAF 91.3 FM and Theater Squared invite you to register for Theater Squared's 5th season celebration giveaway. One lucky winner will receive two 2010 season subscriptions, which will feature Alfred Hitchcock's The 39 Steps, Every Christmas Story Ever Told, and Then Some, Sundown Town, and Reasons to Be Pretty. You'll also be treated to dinner for two at Ella's Restaurant, plus a two-night weekend stay at the Inn at Carnal Hall in Fayetteville. The drawing will be held Friday, September 3rd, during Film Score Friday with PJ Robowski. You can find more information and you can register at kuaf.com. Please, only one entry per person. Good luck. For today's forecast, we'll have a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. We'll have partly cloudy skies with a high near 91. Tonight, there's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low around 72. On Wednesday, we'll continue to have a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high near 88 and a low around 70. Support for Ozarks at Large comes from Collier Drug Stores, offering a prescription refill hotline at 1-888-237-6261 and local delivery from 6 Collier's locations in Northwest Arkansas. More information is available on the web at collierdrug.com. For classical music, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, tune in to KUAF HD2, available on your HD radio or online at kuaf.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great day.